This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
We've had seismic changes in the last decade, and we've adapted to them. But what comes next?
We really talk about autonomous business processes rather than just automating business processes.
I'm Chip Kleinexel, host of Resilient Edge, a business vitality podcast paid and presented by Deloitte. Our latest episode explores how to build a digital brain and future-proof your business. Vision to Value on Resilient Edge is available now, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Stell dir vor, 400 Führungskräfte in einem Raum und alle reden offen über ihre Fehler und Erfolge. Genau das ist die Manage Agile. Bei der Manage Agile geht's um New Leadership, Teambuilding, Future Work, Unternehmensorganisation und KI in der Führung. Hier wird berichtet, was wirklich funktioniert. Knüpfkontakte, die bleiben. Manage Agile, 11. bis 13. November in Potsdam. Auf manage-agile.de sparst du 5% mit dem Code MANAGE5. Alles klein.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The Briefing Room is the mind space in the metaverse where a big subject becomes clear in less than half an hour with the assistance of the top experts. This week, drought and floods. What's the problem with water in Britain? It might be hard to imagine after the heavy rain this week, but much of England is experiencing drought conditions. We dealt with the problem of sewage in rivers recently on the programme, but right now both rivers and reservoirs are running low, and the water companies have told millions to stop using their hose pipes. Of course, we'll cope. The really bad news, though, is that this is a warm glimpse of a hot future. Scientists say Britain faces a much higher risk of drought in the decades ahead because of climate change. Are we ready for it? And if not, what needs to be done? Step into the briefing room and together we'll find out. Joining me first in the briefing room is Sir John Armitt, the chairman of the National Infrastructure Commission. In 2018, the Commission reported on England's state of preparedness for a drier future. Sir John Armitt, what did the report conclude about the risk of drought in the next few years?
It concluded that the risk of a serious drought was a 1 in 4 chance between now and 2050, and the risk of an extreme drought was 1 in 17. It decided and it recommended that in order to deal with that, we ought to make sure we've got additional capacity in the system of somewhere between 3 and 4 million litres a day. So basically, we've talked about 4 million litres a day extra needed by 2050. So what we're seeing at the moment is drought. We're not seeing an extreme drought where, in fact, they are having to ship water in, they're having to put tankers on the roads, they're having to put standpipes out, they're having to deliver bottled water. What is driving the likelihood of an extreme drought, of course, is continuing growth in the overall temperature of the world, and therefore the likelihood of continued extreme weather circumstances must be high probability between now and 2050.
Okay, so let's talk about what getting that extra capacity actually means. In very broad terms, what should be the strategy to get there?
We break it down into very approximately a third, a third, a third. So three key approaches to take. One is to, as always with all of these things, try and reduce demand. Another way to improve our resilience is to reduce leakage. At the moment, roughly 20% of the water which goes into the system is lost through leakage, and we recommended that they cut that leakage by 50% by 2050. So get the water companies to invest, take action, and reduce their leakage by 50% by 2050. And then the other third could come from having more water in the supply side by building more reservoir capacity, or in addition, providing water transfer schemes. So you transfer water from where you've got a surplus in the country to the areas where you are likely to have a shortage.
Let's look up for a moment at reservoirs. When was the last reservoir built?
Well, the last one which was opened was Carsington, which I think was about 88. The largest one completed relatively recently, or 40 years ago now, was Keilor. So Kildare was completed in about 82, and that's the largest reservoir in the country. Before that, you had Rutland Water, which was completed in the 60s, in fact. So we had a spate of reservoir construction, nothing since that.
Now, we had a significant population increase since that point. So why haven't we been building reservoirs, if you like, to keep up with that?
Well, they're the most capital-intensive thing that you can invest in. So you've got the natural reluctance, I guess, of the private companies to lay out shed loads of capital to build new reservoirs. No great pressure on them, to be frank, from the regulator to build new reservoir capacity. And, of course, everyone knowing that as soon as you propose a large new reservoir, you are going to run into local resistance from the local population, who won't want to see 2 or 3 square miles, potentially maybe 4 square miles of agricultural land devoted to a new reservoir.
Or as in the case of Wales back in the day, whole villages.
Well, indeed, yes. And of course, one of the biggest in Wales is Lake Vyrnwy, which would be the potential source in a water transfer scheme.
Right. And the water transfer scheme, what would we have to do to get that to be more efficient or more effective?
Essentially, you are transferring water from one river basin to another. So you'd be transferring it from Wales, and work has already started on this between Severn Trent and Thames Water. So Severn Trent control Lake Vyrnwy, mid Wales, and the Thames, obviously, and they control the Severn as well, and the Thames control the Thames Basin. And the plan that they have is to shift water, and it could be as much as 300 to 500 million litres a day between those two catchment areas. And you do it through a series of pipework or through the canal system.
So that's progress. Is it going to be enough to meet the objectives that you set out in the Commission's report?
No, it wouldn't. It would make a contribution towards that. I mean, it would make roughly 10, 12% contribution to the absolute total. And it would make about a 30% contribution to the 1.3, 1.4 that we were proposing would come from transfer schemes and reservoirs.
Now, of course, the most famous problem, which everybody talks about because everybody sees it, is the problem of water loss through leaks. And the same question gets asked over and over again, and seems to have been for the last couple of decades, which is why can't the water companies just do more about it?
Well, again, it's an investment. It's a complex issue. They don't know where all the leaks are, so they've got to start by understanding their network better. They've got to understand and research exactly where these leaks are occurring. That requires some smart technology. And then they've got to fix the leaks, and that can be very disruptive if you're fixing leaks in a city. Less disruptive, obviously, if it's out in the countryside somewhere. You may be able to fix it internally by lining pipes, or in fact, you may need to dig them up, which is pretty disruptive. So there's clearly been a natural reluctance to invest the money and get on with it. They've been under a lot of pressure publicly and, of course, through the regulator. And they are currently working to a 15% reduction by 2025. They agreed that they would take that objective back in 2019 in a settlement with the regulator, and the regulator would report to you today that about 3/4 of the companies are making good progress on that and 1/4 are lagging behind that target.
John, you're an expert in essentially finding ways to get people to cough up for projects that need to be done in the long term. What you've described sounds incredibly expensive. What are the broad ways in which you pay for this new infrastructure?
Well, we all pay for our infrastructure one way or the other. We either pay as a customer to the provider, or we pay it through general taxation. So at the end of the day, you know, I think we tend to forget at times, we, the public, pay for our infrastructure. How we pay for it is very simple. We either pay for it to the guy who's supplying it to us, whether it's energy or water or telecoms, or we pay through general taxation, and that's primarily how our roads and railways are paid for, through general taxation.
Sir John Armitt, that's the scale of the challenge. Let's look next at who uses what water. Dr. Heather Smith is Senior Lecturer in Water Governance at Cranfield University. Heather Smith, can we start with how water is used in the UK? So in the first instance, how much of it is used by households?
50% of what we take out of the environment, roughly, goes to household use on average over the course of a year. But that, obviously, that level of demand can change seasonally
If 50% goes to households on average, where does the rest go?
A lot of it goes to industry, particularly the power generation industry. It's used for things like cooling. Over the course of the year, agricultural demand is generally fairly low, only about 1% or 2%, but that can increase quite drastically. So when it's hot and dry, the demand for agriculture in some parts of the UK can be 40 or 50% of what comes out of the environment.
How do we compare in the amount of water we use per person for household use with other European countries?
In general, we're on the higher side. There's a mindset here about it being a rainy country, which I think gives people the idea that there's tons of water and we can just use as much as we want sometimes. And so there are some probably wasteful practices built into our mentality towards water. There's a fair bit of difference between how we see the water use compared to some European countries, maybe where water scarcity is a bit more prevalent.
Is household consumption now going up or down?
If you look at the figure that tends to be spoken about, it's 140 litres per person per day that we use on average. That has remained relatively steady over sort of the past decade or so. We did see a bit of an uplift as a result of COVID due to increased hygiene practices, so increased washing, showering, washing clothes, that type of thing. But if you go back a few decades, our per capita demand tends to be quite a bit higher compared to what we used to use in, say, the 1970s.
Well, you've suddenly made me remember that bath day used to be something in Britain. In other words,
exactly.
You didn't take a bath or shower every day. So that may help explain that. Let's look at ways in which you might try and get demand down. Where would you start?
A good place to start is with metering. In the UK, we're quite a ways behind a lot of European countries when it comes to the installation of meters. We're still only probably just over half of households have water meters installed. And there's really solid evidence that households with meters use less water than households without meters.
How about public information campaigns? I mean, I remember when people were advised to bath with a friend. Do those work?
They can. They tend to have a limited impact in a short term. What we see is people can become desensitized to that kind of messaging fairly quickly. And I think another aspect of it is you don't necessarily understand the full extent of your usage. So you might assume that you don't use very much. So, I don't have to pay attention.
Are there any other things that people could do in their homes beyond metering?
There are always lots of behavioral changes that people can make, changes in how we water our gardens, for instance. During hot weather, don't use tap water. Let your lawn go brown if you can. They will bounce back as soon as there's rain, so there's no need to use a lot of water on that. Even better, rethink your garden design. Plant plants that aren't water hungry to begin with. You can capture different forms of water in the house. You can reuse grey water that comes from sinks and showers and baths. So there's lots of different little behavioural changes that people can make in the house to bring their water usage down.
Now, what about the price signal? If water were more expensive, wouldn't that send a signal to people that water is actually a more scarce resource than they think and they might use less?
It can. There are good reasons why the price of water might have to go up. Partly that would be to influence demand, but in practice, it doesn't have a huge impact on demand with small price changes because those who adjust their usage based on the price going up don't tend to be the biggest users. And the biggest users tend to be those who can afford to pay whatever the price is.
Right. What about recycling our water outside the home? How good are we as a country at doing that?
We're not very good at all. It's something that we definitely have to look at in future.
What's the problem with doing it? Why are we slow? Is there public resistance to it?
There's a fear of public resistance. There have been countries in the world where these kinds of schemes have been met with public resistance. But I think on the whole, it just hasn't been seen as necessary here for a long time. Whereas now I think it's becoming more at the forefront of planning.
I'm just wondering whether, you talked about this public resistance, whether we're dealing with a kind of squeamishness here about the idea of using water that has actually once had effluent in it.
I think there is a level of squeamishness with it. It's often referred to as the yuck factor in studies on this. But I do think in some of the work we've done, support for the idea does seem to be growing. So perhaps we will see less of the squeamishness in future.
make an interesting public information campaign, though, won't it?
I think a long-term public conversation on this is definitely helpful.
Dr. Heather Smith. Next on The Briefing Room, I want to find out about how the industry is planning for the difficult future. Jean Spencer is director of the Water Industry Forum. She used to be an executive at Anglia Water. So, Jean Spencer, we have a housepipe ban in London and drought conditions in much of England. Should we read this as being some kind of failure on the part of the water companies, or is this something they planned for?
Well, David, it is something that we plan for. So 25-year water resource plans and the drought plans that go alongside that are not based on unrestricted supplies in all circumstances. There is a role for hosepipe bans, and in general, we would expect to see those coming to place once every 10 years. So in any individual year, a 10% annual average risk. And it's very clearly set out when those restrictions come into place. And given we've just had one of the driest 6 month periods in the last 100 years and one of the driest Julys on record, then our plans would say that we'd expect to see hosepipe bans to be introduced.
One of the major charges that's been levelled against the way in which water has been funded in this country is that there hasn't been sufficient investment by water companies since privatisation in 1989. I'm pretty sure that you'll say that's wrong.
It is. Since the mid-90s, there's been $160 billion of investment since privatisation. And perhaps it's also worth just remembering the position we were in at privatisation. At that point, you know, we had had severe restrictions in the 70s. There was massive investment required in drinking water quality and a huge backlog on maintenance. And that investment would have been challenging if it had had to take priority alongside all of the other government priorities.
So the picture may not be, is more nuanced than quite a lot of people think. But then people look at the famous question of the leaks, and then you get the answers from the companies about why it is that fixing the leaks are so difficult. And it makes you wonder whether water companies and the regulators may not have been looking in the wrong place. In other words, looking more at reducing the cost of water than they did at safeguarding supply and stopping leaks.
Reducing leakage is absolutely a key part of the strategy for more resilient water supplies. If you think about where we were in planning water resources over the long term until a few years ago, we're in a position where resources were pretty stable and water companies had to demonstrate that there was a deficit in their water supply demand balance and that reducing leakage was the cheapest way of bridging that gap. So leakage was reduced to an extent, but it did largely stay the same. But it's important to emphasise that companies did meet their leakage targets in that period.
Yes, they met their targets. But I suppose my question is, were the targets wrong? Should the targets have been higher? And should they have been at the expense possibly of higher water costs?
Potentially, and it's not the decision we would make today. There has been a fundamental shift in the approach to reducing leakage. So there had to be an economic case for investing in reducing leakage at the expense of bills increasing. And the view was taken that given we were meeting the targets that had been set for resilience around water supplies, that case was difficult to make. But that has now absolutely changed.
Jean Spencer. So how should we think about the future? Sir Dieter Helm is Professor of Economic Policy at Oxford University and the author of several books on environmental economics. Dieter Helm, can you remind us what the government's case for privatisation of water in England and Wales was back in 89?
The argument for privatisation was based on several different bits. One was just the ideological belief that the private sector would be vastly more efficient than the public sector, especially if it's incentivized to make significant profits. It was argued that it would invest and that somehow the government couldn't invest, only the private sector could do it. And that the combination of these factors would open up a new renaissance for the water industry, in which it would put right what was thought to be underinvestment in the past, and by the high-powered efficiency incentives, become an exemplar of the best water companies in Europe or in the world.
We heard earlier from Gene Spencer of the Water Industry Forum that the water companies, if you look at it in an objective way, don't have that bad a record on investment. Do you agree?
If it's the total amount of investment, it's neither particularly bad or particularly good. The relevant question isn't, was it more investment compared with the 1980s in the 1990s and beyond, but was it the right amount of investment for the needs of the time and now? And were the balance sheets and the financial muscle of these companies used to finance that investment, or were they used for what turns out to be one of the greatest episodes of financial engineering that any sector has faced?
Dieter, can you just explain what you mean by financial engineering?
Well, the balance sheets, the capacity to borrow of the newly privatized companies, was there to carry out investments. So, yes, there'd be debt, but yes, there'd be new investments too. Perfectly practical way of thinking about how to build out assets into the future. But that's not what the newly privatized companies did. Instead, they basically mortgaged their assets. So they borrowed lots and lots of money, not for investment, but they borrowed it to essentially take out cash from the businesses. And they did that by effectively the equivalent of going down to the bank and saying, you know, how much money will you lend me against my house? And to imagine at the end of that process that if you mortgaged up your house, you would in some sense be as able to do other stuff, invest, etc., is an illusion. But this happened on a huge scale and the regulators failed to stop it. And it was exacerbated by a phenomenal mergers and acquisitions jamboree. So you had companies changing hands many times over. And again, part of the changing over was to do more of this gearing up of the balance sheet, more of the mortgaging of the assets.
Is what you're saying that you could conceivably have a nationalised water industry that performed just as badly or well as a privatised one? The issue is what you asked it to do.
Yes, the companies did exactly what the incentives encouraged them to do. And the most profitable thing to do was financial engineering. And they did it. And they also paid themselves lots of money, which would not have been paid in the public sector. So you get what's on the tin. And in this particular example, the regulators and the government failed to put in a framework to harness private incentives, private initiative, private entrepreneurship to deliver what we, the public, want.
Now, to what extent do you think that the regulators decided that they wanted to placate the electorate by concentrating on low water costs at the expense of investment in infrastructure?
There's no doubt that one of the illusions that people had at privatization, that, you know, the companies would do whatever's necessary and needs to be done and we just pay for it, that illusion was rapidly replaced by the political reality that governments lent on regulators to make sure the prices didn't go up too much and for understandable, affordable reasons. So instead of saying, so what do we need to do to have a properly functioning, sustainable water and sewage industry? How much do we need to spend? The question became something very different, which is, if the bills don't go up, what could you do for that? And that's a looking out the back window approach, which if you've got substantive changes going on all around you, environmental and other, is not going to be fit for purpose.
What we've been talking about mostly is the way in which the industry has been structured in England. How does that compare with the other home nations, Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland? And how does it compare to the rest of Europe?
Well, I think the first thing to say about comparisons is that virtually nobody else in the world pursues the model that we pursued in England and Wales. Almost everywhere, the water industry is in the public sector and has remained in the public sector, be it Scotland or it be across almost all of Europe. That's quite helpful because it enables us to make a comparison. You know, 30 years later, is it true that the England and Wales companies with these high-powered incentives, high salaries, high profits, are much more efficient than their European counterparts? So we've got a big benefit for paying a higher price for what we've got. And the answer is nobody's come up with any convincing evidence that despite paying the higher returns and the higher salaries, that the English and Wales companies are any better or indeed worse than what happens in Europe or elsewhere. Scotland's harder to compare because Scotland's geology and geography and structures are very different from what we find in the south.
Let's look forward. Of what you understand about the water industry's plans for the next few decades, into which, of course, they're now having to build substantial amounts of investment for resilience, are they an improvement?
My beef with the way in which the companies are going forward is that, in a serious sense, they're asking the wrong question. So what we do in the UK with regard to infrastructure, public or private sector, is we basically start from where we are and think what sticky plasters we can apply. What's the minimum we can do to patch up the roads? What's the minimum we can do to patch up the railways? And when it comes to water, well, you know, how can we edge forward a bit on leakage? How can we edge forward a bit and clean up some of the sewage going into the rivers? Now, I think we need to start the other way around. We need to have a 21st century water industry, not a 19th and 20th century industry. And we need to address the questions over the next 30 years which we confront. So I ask the question, what would good look like? What sort of water system do you need in the face of climate change, in the face of population development pressures, in the face of the state of our rivers and the state of our pipes, etc.? And just edging forward and saying, you know what, we're going to ratchet up the leakage reduction target by a couple of percent, doesn't start to address those questions. And it's true of our electricity system too. You know, we need a decarbonized 21st century electricity system. And we've left these issues, and the last time they were dealt with were by the Victorians. And it's about time we got onto a 21st century platform.
That, if you like, is the kind of grand statement. Do you have any ability to say what that might look like in practice, very generally?
Yes, I think that it's not hard at all. It's not rocket science to work out what good would look like in the water industry. You know, we would have radically different leakage. We would think seriously about decentralized storage, the housing level, etc. We'd think again about whether we ought to use drinking water to water our garden and clean our cars, whether we could separate out grey water. We would think again about what the sewage system needs to look like in order for rivers to have decent biodiversity and to be able to actually flow and not be over-abstracted. We'd think about what reservoirs and supporting infrastructure we need for large-scale water transfers. So I don't think this is difficult at all. Nobody actually asked the question at these five-year short-term periodic reviews that the industry is subjected to. So what do you want to look like in 2050? I mean, we have net zero for 2050 for the energy sector, which is starting a transformation of thought. Nothing like that exists in the water industry, and that's a mistake.
It sometimes seems to me that the question of privatisation or nationalisation occupies a sort of religious dimension rather than a practical one. In practical terms, would it make a huge amount of difference whether or not water was brought back into public ownership or kept where it is?
I don't think it really matters that much who owns the water companies. What matters is whether they're properly regulated, properly funded, properly financed, and actually do the job they're supposed to do, rather than what we've witnessed in the private sector over the last 30 years.
Sir Dieter Helm, the conclusion to all that is not unfamiliar. Eventually, you pay for short-term thinking, so best to plan long-term. My thanks to Dieter Helm, to John Armit, Heather Smith and Jean Spencer. We'll be back next week. The Briefing Room is presented by me, David Aronovich. It was produced by Kirsty Knight, Bob Howard and Simon Watts. The studio manager was Graham Puttifoot and the editor was Richard Varden. And if you enjoyed this episode of The Briefing Room, there are many others to listen to on BBC Sounds. You can tune in to the one about how to fix Britain's dirty rivers. And there's also an addition about whether the dispute over Taiwan could lead to war in East Asia.
I'm Jade Adams, and in Welcome to the Neighbourhood, I take a peek at the nation's community apps and message boards for some comedy eavesdropping. Does anyone know who's parked on our drive?
I got hit by a potato on the high street earlier.
Could you please have some decency and close the curtains if you're having sex? Each episode, I'll be joined in my online curtain twitching by a different guest, including James Acaster.
You don't need to put out a thing to the local community. You can just go straight to the police.
Sarah Keyworth.
I highly doubt she's read the highway code.
And Helen Bauer.
They're inciting a riot in three sentences.
Welcome to the Neighbourhood with me, Jade Adams, on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Stell dir vor, 400 Führungskräfte in einem Raum und alle reden offen über ihre Fehler und Erfolge. Genau das ist die Manage Agile. Bei der Manage Agile geht's um New Leadership, Teambuilding, Future Work, Unternehmensorganisation und KI in der Führung. Hier wird berichtet, was wirklich funktioniert. Knüpfkontakte, die bleiben. Manage Agile, 11. bis 13. November in Potsdam. Auf manage-agile.de sparst du 5% mit dem Code MANAGE5. Alles klein.
America is changing, and so is the world.
But what's happening in America isn't just the cause of global upheaval. It's also a symptom of disruption that's happening everywhere.
I'm Asma Khalid in Washington, D.C.
I'm Tristan Redman in London, and this is The Global Story.
Every weekday, we'll bring you a story from this intersection, where the world and America meet.
Listen on Amazon Music or wherever you get your podcasts.